You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Paul Ellard Cooley.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is our opportunity to sit down with the amazing guest hosts that we have on the show and peel them like a grape. Just strap them down with duct tape and bludgeon them until they tell us all their secrets. No, of course, that's not how we do things around here. We're gentlemen. We're kind, discreet gentlemen. And actually,
except for tonight,
because tonight it's going to get ugly. But before we do, just real quick, and I don't want to eat into our guest host's 20 minutes. This won't count against him. But Brian, as you well know, Father's Day is just around the corner.
Yes, it is.
And it's very important that Brian and I send out a big, warm, and loving Father's Day greeting to Justin McCumber, Terry Mixon, and our guest host, Paul Cooley, who are the illegitimate fathers of the Roundtable Podcast Love Child. Happy Father's Day!
We love you, daddies.
We need our allowance, please, and the keys to the car.
Good luck with that.
All right, that being done, Brian?
Yeah.
We have awesomeness ahead and in store.
I'm so stoked about this.
And as we've already observed, everybody knows who this guy is, but Dave has this compulsion with intros. So endure with me, fair listeners, as I riff for just a little bit on our co-host. He is the author of Garaga's Children, Legends, Lovers, and the recently released Interlopers. An intriguing series, collection of tales and short stories where he begins in ancient times and slowly wends his way through history, tracing the lineage and dark exploits of the spawn of Garaga. He has also written Fiends, Volume 1, a collection of short stories, Tattoo, Canvas, and Closet Treats, all of which are available separately in ebook format as well, and Fiend Let's, which is four more stories in the same, pardon the pun, vein. Oh. He podcasts just often enough to make you want more, and we do highly recommend that you check out his podcast story, The Street Deep
Yes.
Fried. You endorse that, sir?
Wholeheartedly, but I do have a bone to pick, but we'll get into that.
We'll get to that later. If you like Mickey Spillane and always thought the Muppets were just a little too sweet, this is definitely the tale for you. And you can find all of this dark, visceral goodness at his website, shadowpublications.com. And as if all this fabulosity was not enough, if it has whipped you into a frothing fervor and you just want more, then tune in to one of our favorite podcasts, The Dead Robot Society, where our guest host co-hosts each week with the amazing Justin McCumber and Terry Mixon. Ladies and gentlemen, lock up your daughters, hide the silverware. The Roundtable Podcast is pleased and proud to welcome to the Skype line the Fiendmaster himself, Paul Ellard Cooley. Paul, thank you for coming on to the show, man.
Thank you very much for having me on. I was expecting an applause laugh track after that.
I know. And I keep trying to like bring it down at the end so that expectation isn't there, but it's just not in me. I can't do it. Okay, Paul, we got 20 minutes with you. It's on the clock right now. I'm noting the time. We'll never make it to stay within 20 minutes, but
oh, hell no. We have difficulty with that.
That's right, but yes. But we at least have hopes and dreams someday, maybe. But let's launch into this. One of the things, I read Garaga's Children, Legends, just recently, and really, really enjoyed it. And in listening to some of the interviews that I've heard from you and the descriptions of Lovers and Interlopers, it's these are largely not only horror tales, but wonderful historical tales. And
well, thank you.
The wonderful thing about that I enjoyed about Garaga's Children was the interludes in between where you discuss the research and the history that you drew upon to flesh out these stories. Now, I know a lot of our listeners are writers who want to draw upon history or see history as a rich tapestry or background to tell their tales. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about how you personally, for Garaga's Children, approached history in the context of the story, some of the resources you used and your process for making sure that what's faithful to history stays in there and what doesn't maybe gets left aside.
What doesn't? Well, the wonderful thing about going back as far as I did for the early stuff in GC is that there's very little actually out there, which is wonderful and terrible at the same time. It means that the facts that are there, you've got to be very good with, and the facts that aren't there, you kind of have to make assumptions that may or may not actually be correct, but you can actually go from them. Basically, what I did was when I came up with the idea for the stories and where I wanted to put them was to get familiar with the religions that were known at the time or that we have proof of, as well as get some ideas of the kinds of things that may or may not have happened based on what else occurred in that area, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years later when we do have a pretty good historical record.
Okay, so working backwards from known information. Yeah. Okay.
Right, working backwards from known information and then seeing how it might fit with what was going on. So, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff that you have to go through, and obviously, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh was used a little bit in Lovers, especially, just to try and get a feel for what was going on there. But when you start going into the Fertile Crescent, man, all bets are off when you go back, when you go past about 1500 BCE, we really don't know crap. And I'll make an assertion in the next story that's hopefully coming out in July, Scrolls, as to why that is. Again, I'm basically making a leap, and it's a pretty well-founded leap. But as far as the research goes, you know, I did find some books at Borders of all places. Wow,
it's ancient times.
Yeah, ancient times. They were written in cuneiform and on clay tablets.
We walked to Borders uphill both ways, and we liked it, damn it.
Strangely enough, they were on sale.
Go figure.
Anyway, you know, they had some pretty good accounts of what was going on at the time and some of the religious aspects that were there. And again, I had to make certain leaps of faith, and I hate to say it, but Wikipedia gave me enough links to click through to basically get in. If I needed something, I went and looked for it on Wikipedia, read their synopsis, and went, okay, that's probably bullshit. and then started looking at some of the resources they were talking about, and if I could find you know, some other information to back them up or dispute it, then I was actually in a really good place because I could make some ideas or you know, decisions about what I was going to put in the book. So, I mean, if you're going to do that kind of historical research for ancient history, I think that's pretty much the way you have to approach it. Like in the story Keepers, the port of Lothal existed, but nobody knows if that dock was actually used for ceremony or for merchants.
Right. Right.
So since there's nobody knows, I just said, okay, well, screw it. For this story, I need it to be this. So that's what I chose.
Okay. Okay. And as you're, you know, I assume that there's an impulse. You have a story that you want to tell. You have a rough era that you want to tell it in. What is it that twigs for you when you're cruising through these, you know, epic tapestries of speculation and hearsay in terms of ancient history? How do you know, oh yeah, that's where it's going to be? Well, what twigs that for you?
For Legends, which is The Last Hunter and Keepers.
Right.
I wanted to focus on the Fertile Crescent because that's pretty much where, if you go back and you look at archaeology and all that other garbage, you know, they call it basically not only the Fertile Crescent and the idea that that's where all the agriculture was, but that was where our civilizations ultimately came from. That is where writing was invented. That is where all these things happened, where we learned how to farm. That's pretty much the area, you know, what is now Baghdad and down into Ur, you know, we're talking about Iraq, Syria, parts of Iran, and in the Indus Valley. All that stuff is where everything happened that forged what we have become today, if you go back and you look far enough in history.
Sure.
So I wanted to play in those areas because I thought if there's going to be any religion that's going to come out of this, like, you know, that's where Judaism started, which gave birth to Christianity and Islam, obviously.
Right.
So if you're going to start a new religion or you're going to track it or have any of that kind of stuff going on, hey, why not go back to where all this shit started?
Sure.
So it made sense from that standpoint. For Legends, putting, you know, having both stories kind of start out in the Indus Valley and wherever they end up, I needed them to end up in the actual Fertile Crescent where there was civilization. So Akkad made the most sense. And then for Lovers, I really wanted to write something that took place in Hammurabi's Babylon. I just really wanted to do it.
How come?
I think because it gives me a chance to play with the first legal code that we have and make some dissertations on that, do a little bit of social commentary on that.
Really, Paul, you? Oh, my God, yeah. I'm stunned.
Another part of that was before Gulf War II started, like a year before that, maybe 2 years, Saddam Hussein had actually started rebuilding Babylon, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
They were rebuilding the ruins to try and capture what the city must have originally looked like. And of course, they're a long way from it.
Sure.
But it's really interesting to look at. I was like, shit, man, I got to put a story in this. It's just got to happen.
Right.
And it dovetailed really well because of the laws that would have been going on at the time of Hammurabi. You've got the whole religion of Ishtar, which was very, very sexual in nature, you know, celebrating fertility and whatnot.
Sure.
And that allowed that story to happen.
Okay.
And it always started out with the idea of, hey, what happens when one of the children gets involved with the goddess Ishtar? Ooh, this can't end well. Let's go with that.
For anyone.
So, you know, it gave me a chance to really explore these things and, you know, take the opportunity to explore them as not only a writer, but also as a student of history. And then trying to look at what kinds of things would go forward through the series. It's basically, you know, I'm looking back on history, but I'm looking forward to see how these things are going to forge the other threads that I want to deal with in the future.
Sure.
And again, it just made perfect freaking sense. And with Interlopers, I wanted to really go after Alexander the Great. So I just said, okay, let's take his biggest failure and let's go with that.
Perfect. A horror story in the making.
Exactly. Awesome. And then from there, we're going to travel to Alexandria, Egypt, 48 BCE during the Ptolemaic War.
Oh, that's the next series after Interlopers?
That's the next story. That's the one I'm working on right now that hopefully will be out in July. That is going to deal with the Library of Alexandria, and I will tell you how it burned.
Dude, you are hitting all the hot spots. That's awesome. That's awesome.
From a just a craft perspective, do you find that your research has a tendency to generate the majority of your ideas? Like you start with an idea, you go and you research it, and as you're researching, things just start to connect? Or do you start with kind of an outline and then do more of technical research to make sure that you're doing things correctly?
Well, it depends on the story. The Last Hunter, for instance, I needed to chronicle the first quote-unquote known encounter. And so it made sense to put it there, and I wanted to deal. That forced me to go look at ancient civilizations and customs and things like that that would have been around or that we think were around, you know, obviously before the written word.
Right.
But I had the idea for the story. For Keepers, Keepers actually got driven by what I needed to have happen, and therefore I had to marry the civilization from the Indus Valley to that of Akkad, and that required all the research to happen. But the idea was, hey, I need to get this guy here, and I need to get this stuff down. I need this little quest to happen to make all this stuff work. So I'm kind of driven by the plot at this point as to what I need to do. But while I'm writing the actual stories, after I get the idea for them, I'll be going through and I'll say, you know what? I need to know, what would they have drank at that time? What would they have eaten? What was the marketplace like? Oh, wait, there's no details on that. I guess I'll make some shit up. you know, and you know, right. Simple things that we take for granted, like systems of money.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell is a slice? Well, it's part of a shekel. Well, what the hell is a shekel? you know, you have to go through and
it's a marine animal, isn't it? I think
not yeah. quite.
No. Okay.
So it just depends. The history has been, you know, you said I'm hitting all the hot spots. I'm basically trying to go through areas where I want to put those stories, but I have the idea for why the story makes sense to be put there, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Paul Cooley after this brief promotional break.
Good. Good Lord. Is there no end to these lost cases?
We did make a dent.
A dent? Wellie, it's more like we're trying to lower the Thames a teaspoon at a time.
But consider what we have learned in the process and what new mysteries await us. Here's the case of a mythical creature of Siam coming to the aid of the ministry. Here's another set in your native country of New Zealand that tells of an ancient holy man waking a dragon. And here is an intriguing case of a strange series of heists corresponding with a traveling festival.
Well, since you put it that way, let us proceed. Testing, testing.
Miss Braun, exactly what are you intending to do with that micro? Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
We have talked about this.
And now we're going to podcast it.
Again?
Again.
Tales in the Archives, Volume 2.
The second season of the award-nominated podcast from Pip Ballantyne and T. Morris.
Subscribe for free through iTunes or at the Ministry of Peculiar Currents' website.
Or visit the Kindle store at Amazon.com, the Nook store at BarnesandNoble.com, or Smashwords.com for 99-cent editions of these original shorts.
Find out more at MinistryofPeculiarOccurrences.com.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Paul Cooley.
Now, one of the things that struck me as I was reading The Last Hunter from Legends was it was definitely a horrifying tale. But from a different perspective, it could just as easily be a Robert E. Howard tale. And from a different perspective, it could be, you know, epic fantasy. And I was wondering if you could riff just a little bit on what is it that makes... how do you, when a story occurs to you, how do you then infuse it with that sense of dread and horror that makes people's bowels clench and make sure there's a light that's on? What is that process? What is that mental cycle? Again, for our listeners who may want to ratchet up the horror in their own stories.
Well, I think it kind of depends on what you're writing. But for Hunter, I really needed to make sure that it was suspenseful. It had the air of, and naturally it's a little bit cliched, but you got the last guy on the planet, so to speak, who's got the chance to do, you know, the job his father couldn't do and his father's fathers and et cetera. So basically taking one of the tropes from, you know, one of Campbell's archetypes and running with it. I mean,
and Freud and Jung. So,
exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, grab Frodo, put a sword in his hand and there we go. the way you just keep doing that is I think anyway, from my experience, is you make it as personal to the character involved as possible. And you make the obstacles not just as to what they're facing externally, but what they're facing internally. And when you're talking about somebody who has to go off and do these things by themselves, you have a lot of area to play with indecision, with their lack of confidence, with, you know, am I going to fail the same way that my own father failed?
Okay.
And trying to dig that up. And the other thing is, who the hell's not afraid of a dark cave? I mean,
right. Well, and exactly. There's a deep archetypal fear, a dread that everyone has of the dark closet or the dark hall or the dark cave. Right. And is that what you're searching for? Is that what, you know, because what you described, you know, certainly ratchets up the tension, but the dread, there's a different vibe there.
Well, the dread is you, by interspersing these little details of, you know, what's happened before and what he's thinking as he's going through. Like I think my favorite passage from Hunter is where he's asking himself, did Tiger Mother, you know, growl as she told her children about the, you know, screams of the villagers as they tried to fight it, or, you know, as it sliced them open and all this other kind of stuff. Is basically just keep pouring that on in these tiny little details as he's thinking about things. But once your character is where they're supposed to go, there's two ways of carrying that off. One is, which, you know, traditional suspense where the reader knows something that the character doesn't.
Right.
And that's when you're going, don't go out there alone. The guy with the machete's out there, you stupid bastard. Right. Now, the problem is we've seen it so much in horror movies. It's not suspense. You just sit back and you go, you know what? You're a fucking idiot.
You're going to go outside anyway, aren't you? You dumb shit.
Yeah, exactly.
You deserve to die.
Yeah, and that brings up the other part of that too, is you have to, the reader has to care about the character.
Absolutely. And if you don't make that connection, it doesn't matter what other tricks you do.
Right.
So you have to make the character very, very sympathetic. You have to make them likable to the reader, and then you have to do terrible things to them. Or at least put them in the way of very, very terrible things. And, you know, you can play with all these different archetypes that we have. You have the darkness, you have the unknown, you have, you know, history coming up against you, all these different things. If you go read some Joseph Campbell, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's been there for every, you know, from time out of mind, and every legend you can possibly imagine, or every myth. And I guess in a lot of ways, I kind of go back and I learn just by reading that stuff. I don't really analyze it, but I know when something is going to work or when it's not going to work. Well, usually anyway.
Okay.
So it's just kind of exploration. But what scares you? I mean, as a writer, I think that's a really big and important question to ask yourself. If you're going to be writing horror, if you're going to be writing suspense, you need to get in touch with what your little nightmares were when you were a child, and you need to explore them. And, you know, shit, anybody who tells me they don't still have nightmares as an adult, they're lying.
That's excellent advice. That's excellent advice. Draw on your own fears.
Yeah, you just got to go in there and you got to figure all that out. I mean, it's the writing itself is the trick, but you have to be honest about it, and otherwise it just won't work.
So I'm reminded of this writerly advice that's being bandied about everywhere I turn. You know, you have to hurt your darlings. You have to kill your darlings. And every time you hear that, you just must go, give me a break. I've been doing that since you were pissing your pants. So that comes naturally.
There's a reason why shadowpublications.com's motto is, we don't believe in happy endings.
Awesome.
Well, I think there is a certain level to go, though. I think that you can go way too far with that. If you've done all this work to make this character sympathetic to the audience, to the reader, you can't just kill them off. You can't just, like, you know, the thing ends with them getting run over by a car or something.
Right.
It's got to make sense in the context of the story. And yeah, hurting them, killing them, there's various ways of doing that. And closet treats, I did some really awful things to the protagonist. But, you know, he lives. He lives at the end, and one could make the argument that he ends up winning. But look at everything he lost to get there.
He may not wish he was alive.
Yeah, if you read the end of that book, you'll be really asking that question. So it's really a matter of, you got to figure out what the losses are that you can live with and that your audience can live with. Because there's just certain times where I've read books and it's just kind of like, you know, that was just unnecessary. And it didn't even make sense. What the hell's wrong with that?
Toss the book aside.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, and that goes along with not being a, you know, I'm not a gore hound. I don't write a lot of,
blood
flying everywhere and guts and et cetera. I don't revel in that. I'd rather give you enough details for you to form the picture.
Sure.
So you're going to do a much better job than I ever could. Because you're just as sick as I am.
And it invites the writer or the reader to engage with the material.
Absolutely. If you're giving them everything, then I think you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, Paul. You have an extensive body of work that is constantly growing. And I know you're constantly also working on your own craft. And I'm curious, what are you working on now in terms of improving or refining your skills as a writer and a storyteller?
Oh boy. I think the big thing right now is I'm trying to get out of extreme third person limited omniscient, where I'm just dealing with one character. I'm trying to get to the point where I think for some of the stories I want to tell, I'm going to have multiple characters' points of views, not in the same chapter necessarily, but I'm going to have to deal with a wider group of characters. So I'm trying to basically get myself out of my comfort zone with that and, you know, just kind of play with it. Because it is one of those things that kind of scares me as a writer. I think because I don't really like it as a reader. I don't like those kinds of books. But at the same time, to tell some of the stories that I want to tell, I have to do this.
Okay.
And I know that from an artistic standpoint, know that from a practical standpoint. that I'm going to have to get out of that and go into and basically just say, okay, screw it. I'm going to have, you know, 15 or 16 different guys, and one of these guys may have a chapter that's maybe three paragraphs and he's dead. But the bottom line is I have to have that scene in there.
Sure.
And it's tough for me to do that because it's just so against my nature what I do. Because I don't like throwaway characters. I just don't like them.
Sure. Sure. So are you just, is this on the job training? You're just, as you write these tales, you're pushing that comfort zone of POV, or do you flash fiction or any side work to help, you know, try it out ahead of time before you get into the actual writing of the main story?
It just kind of depends. I mean, sometimes I'll write, track 9, which I'm still working on. It started out with just 3 POVs, and now I've got to go back and I'm going to have to put in about 7 more.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So, and it actually, it's really strange because I went back and I rewrote the beginning because it was only going to have 1 and it just wasn't going to work. So I've continuously been adding to it. But I, you know, I look at it as the same way I do with software, which is I create a prototype, and then once I get the prototype sort of working, then I'll go back and try and design it for real. So there are some throwaway stuff. I usually write 3 or 4, maybe even 6,000 words per longer work that just end up getting tossed.
Okay.
And that, you know, if they don't work, they just don't work. But yeah, I love those words occasionally. And I'll go back and maybe I'll steal from them, or maybe I'll grab that scene and go, you know what, this can work, but,
yeah.
You know, it's just, I'm not afraid to throw away the words. I'm not afraid to write the words. I'm just, what I'm terrified of is wasting my time. And that's another thing I've just really got to get over as a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think every writer wrestles with that first draft has to be perfect. And yeah, exactly. Brian, do you have a quick question for Paul?
Sort of a quick question, quick statement. And Paul, please don't take this the wrong way, but you're
Duncan.
An ass.
Oh, my God.
and here's why. You took my childhood and you mangled it into a quivering mass of frightened gelatinous memory soup.
Okay, we must be talking about
the street. Yeah, yeah, I am. No, actually, I was telling Dave, you know, it took me about 10 minutes to get over it. And by that point, I was like, okay, now I can start to kind of see the brilliance of it. But at first, it was really hard for me not to hunt you down and throw Muppet guts on your.
It's really funny. I did the street as a lark for TuwakaCon. Just the first was just going to write stuffing because I'd never done any real comedy before.
Right.
And I wanted to do something that was just sick and wrong and was funny. And I don't know why I picked up on Sesame Street. I can't even remember what the hell made me do it. But Oscar started talking in my head and went, all right, man, you're cooking with gas. So in 4 hours, I wrote stuffing. And that's pretty much all it took. I mean, the story more or less wrote itself. And it ended up being even more twisted than I had possibly imagined.
Oh, God.
And I put it out there and I was like, well, this is fun, but you know, probably everybody's gonna be like, man, you dumbass. What instead happened was, I got all these emails and all these tweets going, that is the sickest, most wrongest. How dare you? When are you writing the next one?
Right. Yes.
So, and that's pretty much where it is. Right. So, I thought about making it, a Pulp Fiction like series where you end up getting different scenes of a day, but I figured, you know what? Screw that. I love Oscar. I love writing from Oscar's point of view. So I've got 3 or 4 more stories in that series, at least. And the plot lines that I laid down and deep fried are kind of out there and tangling around. And some people have picked up on some of the stuff that's going on. It's just going to be a lot of fun.
And
Oscar is just going to war. It's going to be great.
It's going to be on like Donkey Kong.
Oh, yeah. You wait until I see what I did with Animal. Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. God, that's right. We didn't see Animal. Oh, you bastard. He's my favorite. You are an ass.
There's even a photograph of Dave, you know, doing Rock Band with the Rock Band drums and his hair hanging down. And it's awesome.
And it's orange. I colored the hair all orange. Yeah.
Come on.
He looks
totally.
Like
totally.
Well, see, I have great respect for Animal. So I think you'll like what I'm going to do with it.
Okay. All right.
Fun.
But I do have to say, I think my favorite character manipulation that you did was Big Bird. just on a psychological level.
Yeah, that was
again. One of my beta readers checked that out, and she was just like, "That is just wrong." And I thought that it would work out pretty well. I needed it to be strange and uncomfortable, yeah, and everything else, I had a lot of fun with that. Yeah, thank success. You. I think it's a lot of fun to go look at these childhood characters and really imagine what they would be like if, number one, they were real, mm-hmm, and number two, if you saw them completely off the set.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time in, you know, actors, kids shows, whatever, Pee Wee Herman getting caught, you know, yanking his crank, some little porno theater or whatever it is. You see that all the time. So I'm like, hey man, Muppets could be just as bad, if not worse.
If not worse. Right. Absolutely.
Right. So it was a lot of fun to play with. And I love the fact that, and very, very surprised and happily surprised that, it's gotten so much support and it's come up as popular as it has. So.
Definitely. Friends, do check that out. It is worth your time. And gentlemen, speaking of time, we are out of it and then some. So in keeping with the proud Roundtable Podcast tradition of not staying within 20 minutes, and at this point, you know, if I ever cut off a guest host at 20 minutes, they're going to kick my ass. So yeah, we might as well just call the... we're calling it 20 minutes. And then I'll give the grace and we'll call it good. It's all good.
It's an inside thing.
So that's right. Good. Ooh, yeah. Yes, exactly. You know, the inside crew gets that. So, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you've got a lot going on, and this could have gone on for much longer. I hope, if nothing else, that our listeners got some goodness out of it, and that they check out your stuff. Thank you so much for making the time, man.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Brian, any last words before we close this bad boy down?
No, it was an extreme pleasure, and I'm definitely going to eat up all the rest of the street that you can come up with. So it's great to have you on.
Thanks. Yes, he's jonesing for the dough, baby.
Oh, I can't even tell you, but I'm not going to use the term that's used.
Oh, and friends, thank you so much for tuning in. As always, whenever you tune in, we're grateful that you hit that play button. If you enjoyed the episode, make your way out to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review. We'd love to hear what you think. If you have comments for Paul, make your way out to the Roundtable Podcast website at roundtablepodcast.com. What a shock. We stayed up late coming up with that one. And leave a comment on the episode post. You can drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Holy smokes. And just generally be awesome. And Brian, any suggestions for our audience?
Yeah, go write.
Absolutely. Get out there. Write some stuff down. We would love to see it. And we will see you in just a couple of days when we'll bring Paul back and we'll do some story workshopping. Until then, you guys take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBroyer, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.